speak out.
Though he was more poetic in Pashto, he could speak our national language Urdu and English fluently, which meant he was an effective communicator outside Swat as well as inside. Every day, on behalf of the Swat Council of Elders, he was at seminars or on the media challenging Fazlullah. "What are you doing?" he would ask. "You are playing havoc with our lives and our culture." My father would say to me, "Any organization which works for peace, I will join. If you want to resolve a dispute or come out from conflict, the very first thing is to speak the truth. If you have a headache and tell the doctor you have a stomachache, how can the doctor help? You must speak the truth. The truth will abolish fear." When he met with his fellow activists, particularly his old friends Ahmed Shah, Muhammad Farooq, and Zahid Khan, I often went with him. Ahmed Shah also had a school where Muhammad Farooq worked, and they would sometimes gather on his lawn. Zahid Khan was a hotel owner and had a big hujra. When they came to our house, I would bring them tea, then sit quietly listening as they discussed what to do. "Malala is not just the daughter of Ziauddin," they would say. "She is the daughter of all of us." They went back and forth to Peshawar and Islamabad and gave lots of interviews on the radio, particularly Voice of America and the BBC, taking turns so there would always be one of them available. They told people that what was happening in Swat was not about Islam. My father said the Taliban presence in Swat was not possible without the support of the army and the bureaucracy. The state is meant to protect the rights of its citizens. But it's a very difficult situation when you can't tell the difference between a state and non-state and can't trust the state to protect you against the non-state. Our military and ISI are very powerful, and most people did not like to voice these things publicly, but my father and many of his friends were not scared. "What you are doing is against our people and against Pakistan," he would say. "Don't support Talibanization. It's inhuman. We are told that Swat is being sacrificed for the sake of Pakistan. But no one and nothing should be sacrificed for the state. A state is like a mother, and a mother never deserts her children." He hated the fact that most people would not speak up. In his pocket, he kept a poem written by Martin Niemöller, who had lived in Nazi Germany. It said, "First they came for the communists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for the Catholics, and I did not speak out because I was not a Catholic. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." I knew he was right. If people were silent, nothing would change. At my school, my father organized a peace march and encouraged us to speak out against what was happening. Muniba put it well. "We Pashtuns are a religion-loving people," she said. "Because of the Taliban, the whole world is claiming we are terrorists. This is not the case. We are peace-loving. Our mountains, our trees, our flowers, everything in our valley is about peace." A group of us gave an interview on ATV Khyber, the only private Pashto channel, about girls dropping out of school due to militancy. Teachers helped us beforehand on how to respond to questions. I wasn't the only one to be interviewed. When we were 11 and 12, we did them together. But as we turned 13 or 14, my friends' brothers and fathers didn't allow them because they had entered puberty and should observe Purda, and also they were afraid. One day, I went on Jio, which is one of the biggest news channels in our country. There was a wall of screens in their office. I was astonished to see so many channels. Afterwards, I thought, the media needs interviews. They want to interview a small girl, but the girls are scared. And even if they're not, their parents won't allow it. I have a father who isn't scared, who stands by me. He said, You are a child and it's your right to speak. The more interviews I gave, the stronger I felt and the more support we received. I was only 11, but I looked older, and the media seemed to like hearing from a young girl. One journalist called me Takra Janai, or Bright Shining Young Lady. And another said I was Pakka Janai, wise beyond my years. In my heart was the belief that God would protect me. If I am speaking for my rights, for the rights of girls, I'm not doing anything wrong. It is my duty to do so. God wants to see how we behave in such situations. There is a saying in the Quran, the falsehood has to go and the truth will prevail. If one man, Fazlullah, can destroy everything, why can't one girl change it, I wondered. I prayed to God every night to give me strength. The media in Swat were under pressure to give positive coverage to the Taliban. Some even respectfully called the Taliban spokesman Muslim Khan School Dada, when in reality, he was destroying schools. But many local journalists were unhappy about what was happening to their valley, and they gave us a powerful platform as we would say things they didn't dare to. We didn't have a car, so we went by rickshaw, or one of my father's friends would take us to the interviews. One day, my father and I went to Peshawar to appear on a BBC Urdu talk show hosted by a famous columnist called Wasatullah Khan. We went with my father's friend, Faza Mullah, and his daughter, two fathers and two daughters. To represent the Taliban, they had Muslim Khan, who wasn't in the studio. I was a bit nervous, but I knew it was important as many people all over Pakistan would be listening. How dare the Taliban take away my basic right to education, I said. There was no response from Muslim Khan, because his phone interview had been pre-recorded. How can a recording respond to live questions? Afterwards, people congratulated me. My father laughed and said I should go into politics. Even as a toddler, you talked like a politician, he teased. But I never listened to my interviews. I knew these were very small steps. Our words were like the eucalyptus blossom of spring, tossed away on the wind. The destruction of schools continued. On the night of 7th October 2008, we heard a series of faraway blasts. The next morning, we learnt that masked militants had entered Sangota Convent School for Girls and Excelsior College for Boys and blown them up using improvised explosive devices. The teachers had already been evacuated as they had received threats earlier. These were famous schools, particularly Sangota, which dated from the time of the last Wali and was well known for academic excellence. They were also big. Excelsior had over 2,000 pupils and Sangota had 1,000. My father went there after the bombings and found the buildings completely razed to the ground. He gave interviews to TV reporters amid broken bricks and burnt books and returned home horrified. It's all just rubble, he said. Yet my father remained hopeful and believed there was a day when there would be an end to the destruction. What really depressed him was the looting of the destroyed schools where furniture, the books, the computers were all stolen by local people. He cried when he heard this. They are vultures jumping on a dead body. The next day, we went on a live show on The Voice of America and angrily condemned the attacks. Muslim Khan, the Taliban spokesman, was on the phone. What was so wrong with these two schools that you should bomb them? My father asked him. Muslim Khan said that Sangota was a convent school teaching Christianity and that Excelsior was co-ed, teaching girls and boys together. Both things are false, replied my father. Sangota has been there since the 1960s and never converted anyone to Christianity. In fact, some of them converted to Islam. And Excelsior is only co-ed in the primary section. Muslim Khan didn't answer. What about their own daughters? I asked my father. Don't they want to learn? Our headmistress, Madame Mariam, had studied at Sangota, and her younger sister Aisha was a pupil there, so she and some of the other Sangota girls transferred to our school. The monthly school fees were never enough to cover all our outgoings, so the extra fees were welcome. But my father was unhappy. He went everywhere he could, demanding the reconstruction of both schools. Once he spoke at a big gathering and held up an audience member's baby girl and said, "This girl is our future. Do we want her to be ignorant?" The crowd agreed that they would sacrifice themselves before giving up their daughter's education. The new girls had horrible stories. Aisha told us how one day on the way home from Sangota school, she had seen a Taliban holding up the severed head of a policeman by its hair, blood dripping from the neck. The new girls were also very bright, which meant more competition. One of them, Rida, was excellent at making speeches. She became a good friend of mine and of Muniba's, which sometimes caused fights, as three is a tricky number. Muniba often brought food to school and would just bring one spare fork. "Are you my friend or Rida's friend?" I asked Muniba. "We are all three good friends," she laughed. By the end of 2008, 400 schools had been destroyed by the Taliban. We had a new government under President Asif Zardari, the widow of Benazir, but they did not seem to care about Swat. I told people things would be different if Zardari's own daughters were at school in Swat. There were suicide bombings all over the country. Even the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad had been blown up. In Swat, it was safer in the town than in the remote areas, and many of our family came from the countryside to stay with us. The house was small and got very crowded, what with the cousins who already lived with us. There was little to do. We couldn't play cricket in the street or the roof like we used to. We played marbles in the yard over and over again. I fought non-stop with my brother Khushal, and he would go crying to our mother. Never in history have Khushal and Malala been friends. I liked doing my hair in different styles. I would spend ages in the bathroom in front of the mirror, trying out looks I had seen in movies. Until I was 8 or 9, my mother used to cut my hair short like my brother's because of lice, and also to make it easier to wash and brush as it would get messed up under my shawl. But finally, I had persuaded her to let me grow it to my shoulders. Unlike Muniba, who has straight hair, mine is wavy, and I liked to twist it into curls or tie it into plaits. "What are you doing in there?" my mother would shout. "Our guests need the bathroom, and everyone is having to wait for you." One of the worst times was the fasting month of Ramadan in 2008. During Ramadan, no food or drink can pass a Muslim's lips in daylight hours. The Taliban bombed the power station, so we had no electricity. Then a few days later, they blasted the pipeline, so we had no gas either. The price of the gas cylinders we used to buy from the market doubled, so my mother had to cook on a fire like we did in the village. She didn't complain. Food needed to be cooked, and she cooked it. And there were others worse off than us. There was no clean water, and people started dying from cholera. The hospital could not cope with all the patients and had to erect big tents outside to treat people. Though we had no generator at home, my father bought one to install at the school, and fresh water was pumped from a borehole, which all the children in the neighborhood went to collect. Every day there would be lines of people waiting to fill jugs, bottles, and drums. One of the neighbors got frightened. "What are you doing?" he asked. "If the Taliban find out you're giving water in the month of Ramadan, they will bomb us." My father replied that people will die either of thirst or bomb blasts. The days when we used to go for trips or for picnics seemed like a dream. No one would venture from their homes after sunset. The terrorists even blew up the ski lift and the big hotel in Malam Jabba where tourists used to stay. A holiday paradise turned into hell where no tourist would venture. Then, at the end of 2008, Fazlullah's deputy, Maulana Shau Dauran, announced on the radio that all girls' schools would close. From January 15th, girls must not go to school, he warned. First, I thought it was a joke. How can they stop us from going to school? I asked my friends. They don't have the power. They are saying they will destroy the mountain, but they can't even control the road. The others didn't agree with me. Who will stop them? They asked. They have already blown up hundreds of schools, and no one has done anything. My father used to say, the people of Swat and the teachers will continue to educate our children until the last room, the last teacher, and the last student is alive. My parents never once suggested I should withdraw from school, ever. Though we loved school, we hadn't realized how important education was until the Taliban tried to stop us. Going to school, reading, doing our homework, wasn't just a way of passing time. It was our future. That winter, it snowed, and we built snow bears without much joy. In winter, the Taliban used to disappear into the mountains, but we knew they would be back and had no idea what was coming next. We believed schools would start again. The Taliban could take our pens and books, but they couldn't stop our minds from thinking. 12. The Bloody Square. The bodies would be dumped in the square at night, so that everyone would see them the next morning on their way to work. There was usually a note pinned to them saying something like, "This is what happens to an army agent," or "Do not touch this body until 11 a.m., or you will be next." On some of the nights of the killings, there would also be earthquakes, which made people even more scared, as we connect every natural disaster with a human disaster. They killed Shabana on a bitterly cold night in January 2009. She lived in Banar Bazaar, the narrow street in our town of Mingora, which is famous for its dancers and musicians. Shabana's father said a group of men had knocked at her door and asked her to dance for them. She went to put on her dancing clothes, and when she returned to dance for them, they pulled out their guns and threatened to slit her throat. This happened after the 9 p.m. curfew, and people heard her screaming, "I promise I'll stop. I promise I won't sing and dance again. Leave me, for God's sake. I'm a woman, a Muslim. Don't kill me." Then shots rang out, and her bullet-ridden body was dragged to green chalk. So many bodies had been left there that people started calling it Bloody Square. We heard about Shabana's death the next morning. On Mullah FM radio, Fazlullah said she deserved to die for her immoral character and that any other girls found performing in Banar Bazaar would be killed one by one. We used to be proud of our music and art in Swat, but now most of the dancers fled to Lahore or to Dubai. Musicians took out adverts in the papers saying they had stopped playing and pledging to live pious lives to appease the Taliban. People used to talk about Shabana's bad character, but our men both wished to see her dance and also despised her because she was a dancer. A Khan's daughter can't marry a barber's son, and a barber's daughter can't marry a Khan's son. We Pashtuns love shoes, but don't love the cobbler. We love our scarves and blankets, but do not respect the weavers. The manual workers made a great contribution to our society, but received no recognition. And this is the reason so many of them joined the Taliban, to finally achieve status and power. So people loved to see Shabana dance, but didn't respect her. And when she was murdered, they said nothing. Some even agreed with her killing, out of fear of the Taliban, or because they were in favor of them. Shabana was not a Muslim, they said. She was bad, and it was right that she was killed. I can't say that that was the worst day. Around the time of Shabana's murder, every day seemed like the worst day. Every moment was the worst. The bad news was everywhere. This person's place bombed, this school blown up, public whippings. The stories were endless and overwhelming. A couple of weeks after Shabana's murder, a teacher in Mata was killed when he refused to pull his shalwar above the ankle the way the Taliban wore theirs. He told them that nowhere in Islam is this required. They hung him, and then they shot his father. I couldn't understand what the Taliban were trying to do. They are abusing our religion, I said in interviews. How will you accept Islam if I put a gun to your head and say Islam is the true religion? If they want every person in the world to be Muslim, why don't they show themselves to be good Muslims first? Regularly, my father would come home shaken up due to the terrible things he had witnessed and heard about, such as policemen beheaded, their heads paraded through the town. Even those who had defended Fazlullah at the start, believing his men were the real standard bearers of Islam and given them their gold, began to turn against him. My father told me about a woman who had donated generously to the Taliban while her husband was working abroad. When he came back and found out she had given away her gold, he was furious. One night there was a small explosion in their village, and the wife cried. "Don't cry," said her husband. "This is the sound of your earrings and nose studs. Now listen to the sound of your lockets and bangles." Yet still so few people spoke out. My father's old rival in college politics, Ihsan ul Haq Haqqani, had become a journalist in Islamabad and organized a conference on the situation in Swat. None of the lawyers and academics he had invited from Swat to speak turned up. Only my father went. It seemed that people had decided the Taliban were here to stay and had better get along with them. "When you are in the Taliban, you have 100% life security," people would say. That's why they volunteered their young men. The Taliban would come to people's houses demanding money to buy Kalashnikovs, or they would ask them to hand over their sons to fight with them. Many of the rich fled. The poor had no choice but to stay and survive the best they could. So many of our men had gone to the mines or to the Gulf to work, leaving their families fatherless. The sons were easy prey. The threats began to come closer to home. One day, Ahmad Shah received a warning from unknown people that they would kill him, so for a while he left for Islamabad to try to raise awareness there of what was happening to our valley. One of the worst things about that period was when we started to doubt one another. Fingers were even pointed at my father. "Our people are being killed. But this Ziyadeen is so outspoken and he's still alive. He must be a secret agent." Actually, he had been threatened too, but hadn't told us. He had given a press conference in Peshawar demanding that the military act against the Taliban and go after their commanders. Afterwards, people told him his name was heard on Mullah FM in a threat from Shah Duran. My father brushed it off, but I was worried. He was outspoken and involved in so many groups and committees that he often wouldn't come home till midnight. He started to sleep at one of his friends' houses to protect us in case the Taliban came for him. He couldn't bear the thought of being killed in front of us. I could not sleep until he returned and I could lock the gate. When he was at home, my mother would place a ladder in the backyard up to the outside wall so he could get down to the street below if he was in sudden danger. He laughed at the idea. Maybe Atal the squirrel could make it, but not me. My mother was always trying to think of plans for what she would do if the Taliban came. She thought of sleeping with a knife under her pillow. I said I could sneak into the toilet and call the police. My brothers and I thought of digging a tunnel. Once again, I prayed for a magic wand to make the Taliban disappear. One day, I saw my little brother Atal digging furiously in the garden. "What are you doing?" I asked him. "Making a grave," he said. Our news bulletins were full of killings and death, so it was natural for Atal to think of coffins and graves. Instead of hide-and-seek and cops and robbers, children were now playing army versus Taliban. They made rockets from branches and used sticks for Kalashnikovs. These were their sports of terror. There was no one to protect us. Our own Deputy Commissioner, Saeed Javed, was going to the Taliban meetings, praying in their mosque and leading their meetings. He became a perfect Talib. One target of the Taliban were non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, which they said were anti-Islam. When the NGOs received threatening letters from the Taliban and went to the DC to ask for his help, he wouldn't even listen to them. Once in a meeting, my father challenged him, "Whose orders are you representing? Fazlullah's or the government's?" We say in Arabic, "People follow their king." When the highest authority of your district joins the Taliban, then Talibanization becomes normal. We like conspiracy theories in Pakistan, and we had many. Some believed the authorities were deliberately encouraging the Taliban. They said the army wanted the Taliban in Swat because the Americans wanted to use an airbase there to launch their drones. With the Taliban in the valley, our government could say to the Americans, "We can't help you because we have our own problems." It was also a way to answer growing American criticism that our military was helping the Taliban rather than trying to stop them. Now our government could respond, "You say we are taking your money and aiding these terrorists, but if that's the case, why are they attacking us too?" "The Taliban obviously have the support of unseen forces," said my father. "But what's happening is not simple, and the more you want to understand, the more complex it becomes." That year, 2008, the government even released Sufi Muhammad, the founder of the TNSM, from prison. He was said to be more moderate than his son-in-law Fazlullah. There was hope that he would make a peace deal with the government who imposed Sharia law in Swat and release us from Taliban violence. My father was in favor of this. We knew this would not be the end, but my father argued that if we had Shariat, the Taliban would have nothing more to fight for. They should then put down their arms and live like ordinary men. If they did not, he said, this would expose them for what they really were. The army still had their guns on the mountains overlooking Mingora. We would lay in bed listening to them, boom, boom, all night. They would stop for 5, 10 or 15 minutes and then start up again the moment we drifted off to sleep. Sometimes, we covered our ears or buried our heads under pillows. But the guns were close by, and the noise was too loud to block out. Then, the morning after on TV, we would hear of more Taliban killings and wonder what the army was doing with all its booming cannons and why they could not even stop the daily broadcasts on Mullah FM. Both the army and the Taliban were powerful. Sometimes their roadblocks were less than a kilometer apart on the same main roads. They would stop us, but seemed unaware of each other's presence. It was unbelievable. No one understood why we were not being defended. People would say they were two sides of the same coin. My father said we common people were like chaff caught between the two stones of a watermill. But he still wasn't afraid. He said we should continue to speak out. "I am only human, and when I heard the guns, my heart used to beat very fast. Sometimes I was afraid, but I said nothing, and it didn't mean I would stop going to school. But fear is very powerful, and in the end, it was this fear that had made people turn against Shabana. Terror had made people cruel. The Taliban bulldozed both our Pashtun values and the values of Islam. I tried to distract myself by reading Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, which answered big questions such as how the universe began and whether time could run backwards. I was only 11 years old, and already I wished it could. We Pashtuns know the stone of revenge never decays, and when you do something wrong, you will face the music. But when would that be? We continually asked ourselves. 13. The Diary of Gul Makai. It was during one of those dark days that my father received a call from his friend Abdul Hai Kakar, a BBC radio correspondent based in Peshawar. He was looking for a female teacher or a schoolgirl to write a diary about life under the Taliban. He wanted to show the human side of the catastrophe in Swat. Initially, Aisha agreed, but her father found out and refused his permission, saying it was too risky. When I overheard my father talking about this, I said, "Why not me?" I wanted people to know what was happening. "Education is our right," I said, "just as it is our right to sing. Islam has given us this right and says that every girl and boy should go to school. The Quran says we should seek knowledge, study hard, and learn the mysteries of our world." I had never written a diary before and didn't know how to begin. Although we had a computer, there were frequent power cuts in those days, and few places had internet access. So Hai Kakar would call me in the evening on my mother's mobile. He would use his wife's phone to protect us, as he said his own phone was bugged by the intelligence services. He would guide me, asking me questions about my day and asking me to tell him small anecdotes or talk about my dreams. We would speak for half an hour or 45 minutes in Urdu, even though we are both Pashtun, as the blog was to appear in Urdu, and he wanted the voice to be as authentic as possible. Then he would write up my words, and once a week they would appear on the BBC Urdu website. He told me about Anne Frank, a 13-year-old Jewish girl who hid from the Nazis with her family in Amsterdam during the war. He told me she kept a diary about their lives all cramped together and how they spent their days and about her own feelings. It was very sad, as in the end the family was betrayed and arrested, and Anne died in a concentration camp when she was only 15. Later her diary was published and is a very powerful record. Hai Kakar told me it could be dangerous to use my real name and gave me the pseudonym Gul Makai, which means cornflower, and is the name of the heroine in a Pashtun folk story. It's a kind of Romeo and Juliet story where Gul Makai and Musa Khan meet at school and fall in love. But they are from different tribes, so their love causes a war. However, unlike Shakespeare's play, their story doesn't end in tragedy. Gul Makai uses the Quran to teach her elders that war is bad, and they eventually stop fighting and allow the lovers to reunite. My first diary entry appeared on 3rd January 2009 under the heading, "I am afraid." I had a terrible dream last night filled with military helicopters and Taliban. I've had such dreams since the launch of the military operation in Swat. I wrote about being afraid to go to school because of the Taliban edict and looking over my shoulder all the time. I also described something that happened on my way home from school. I heard a man behind me saying, "I will kill you." I quickened my pace, and after a while I looked back to see if he was following me. To my huge relief, I saw he was speaking on his phone. He must have been talking to someone else. It was thrilling to see my words on the website. I was a bit shy to start with, but after a while I got to know the kind of things Hai Kakar wanted me to talk about and became more confident. He liked personal feelings and what he called pungent sentences, and also the mix of everyday family life with the terror of the Taliban. I wrote a lot about school, as that was the center of our lives. I loved my royal blue school uniform, but we were advised to wear plain clothes instead and hide our books under our shawls. One extract was called, "Do Not Wear Colorful Clothes." In it, I wrote, "I was getting ready for school one day and was about to put on my uniform when I remembered the advice of our principal. So that day, I decided to wear my favorite pink dress." I also wrote about the burqa. When you are very young, you love the burqa because it's great for dressing up. But when you are made to wear it, that's a different matter. Also, it makes walking difficult. One of my diary entries was about an incident that happened when I was out shopping with my mother and cousin in the China Bazaar. There we heard gossip that one day a woman was wearing a shuttlecock burqa and fell over. When a man tried to help her, she refused and said, Don't help me, brother, as this will bring immense pleasure to Fazlullah. When we entered the shop we were going to, the shopkeeper laughed and told us he got scared, thinking we might be suicide bombers, as many suicide bombers wore the burqa. At school, people started talking about the diary. One girl even printed it out and brought it in to show my father. "It's very good," he said with a knowing smile. I wanted to tell people it was me, but the BBC correspondent had told me not to, as it could be dangerous. I didn't see why, as I was just a child, and who would attack a child? But some of my friends recognized incidents in it, and I almost gave the game away in one entry when I said, "My mother liked my pen name Gul Makai and joked to my father we should change my name. I also like the name because my real name means grief-stricken." The diary of Gul Makai received attention further afield. Some of the newspapers printed extracts. The BBC even made a recording of it using another girl's voice. I began to see that the pen and the words that come from it can be much more powerful than machine guns, tanks, or helicopters. We were learning how to struggle, and we were learning how powerful we are when we speak. Some of our teachers stopped coming to school. One said he had been ordered by Mullah Fazlullah to help build his center in Imam Deri. Another said he'd seen a beheaded corpse on the way in and could no longer risk his life to teach. Many people were scared. Our neighbors said the Taliban were instructing people make it known to the mosque if their daughters were unmarried so they could be married off, probably to militants. By the start of January 2009, there were only 10 girls in my class, when once there had been 27. Many of my friends had left the valley so they could be educated in Peshawar, but my father insisted we would not leave. Swat has given us so much. In these tough days, we must be strong for our valley, he said. One night, we all went for dinner at the house of my father's friend, Dr. Afzal, who runs a hospital. After dinner, when the doctor was driving us home, we saw masked Taliban on both sides of the road carrying guns. We were terrified. Dr. Afzal's hospital was in an area that had been taken over by the Taliban. The constant gunfire and curfews had made it impossible for the hospital to function, so he had moved it to Barikot. There had been an outcry, and the Taliban spokesman, Muslim Khan, had called on the doctor to reopen it. He had asked for my father's advice. My father told him, "Don't accept good things from bad people." A hospital protected by the Taliban was not a good idea. Dr. Afzal did not live far from us, so once we were safely home, my father insisted on going back with him in case he was targeted by the Taliban. As he and my father drove back, Dr. Afzal nervously asked him, "What name shall we give if they stop us?" "You are Dr. Afzal, and I am Ziauddin Yousafzai," replied my father. "These bloody people, we haven't done anything wrong. Why should we change our names? That's what criminals do." Fortunately, the Taliban had disappeared by the time they drove back. We all breathed a big sigh of relief when my father phoned to say they were safe. I didn't want to give in either, but the Taliban's deadline was drawing closer. Girls had to stop going to school. How could they stop more than 50,000 girls from going to school in the 21st century? I kept hoping something would happen and the schools would remain open. But finally, the deadline was upon us. We were determined that Hushal's school bell would be the last to stop ringing. Madam Maryam had even got married so she could stay in Swat. Her family had moved to Karachi to get away from the conflict, and as a woman, she could not live alone. Wednesday, 14th January, was the day my school closed. I was shocked when I woke up that morning and saw TV cameras in my bedroom. A Pakistani journalist called Irfan Ashraf was following me around, even as I said my prayers and brushed my teeth. I could tell my father was in a bad mood. One of his friends had persuaded him to participate in a documentary for the New York Times website to show the world what was happening to us. A few weeks before, we had met the American video journalist Adam Ehrlich in Peshawar. It was a funny meeting, as he conducted a long interview with my father in English, and I didn't say a word. Then he asked if he could talk to me, and began asking questions, using Irfan as an interpreter. After about 10 minutes of this, he realized from my facial expressions that I could understand him perfectly. "You speak English?" he asked me. "Yes, I was just saying there is a fear in my heart," I replied. Adam was astonished. "What's wrong with you people?" he asked Irfan and my father. "She speaks better English than the rest of you, and you're translating for her." We all laughed. The original idea for the documentary had been to follow my father on the last day of school. But at the end of the meeting, Irfan Ashraf asked me, "What would you do if there comes a day when you can't go back to your valley and your school?" I said this wouldn't happen. Then he insisted, and I started to weep. I think it was then that Adam decided he should focus on me. Adam could not come to Swat because it was too dangerous for foreigners. When Irfan and a cameraman arrived, our uncle who was staying with us said over and over that it was too risky to have cameras in our house. My father kept telling them to hide the cameras. But they had come a long way, and it's hard for us as Pashtuns to refuse hospitality. Besides, my father knew this could be our megaphone to the outside world. His friend had told him it would make far more impact than him roaming from pillar to post. I had done a lot of television interviews and enjoyed speaking into the microphone so much that my friends would tease me. But I had never done anything like this. "Be natural," Irfan told me. That wasn't easy with the camera trained on me even as I brushed my teeth. I showed them the uniform that I couldn't wear and told them I was scared that if the Taliban caught me going to school, they would throw acid in my face, as they had to girls in Afghanistan. We had a special assembly that final morning, but it was hard to hear with the noise of helicopters overhead. Some of us spoke out against what was happening in our valley. The bell rang for the very last time, and then Madam Miriam announced it was winter vacation. But unlike in other years, no date was announced for the start of term. Even so, some teachers still gave us homework. In the yard, I hugged all my friends. I looked at the honors board and wondered if my name would ever appear on it again. Exams were due in March, but how could they take place? Coming first didn't matter if you couldn't study at all. When someone takes away your pens, you realize quite how important education is. Before I closed the school door, I looked back as if it were the last time I would ever be at school. That's the closing shot in one part of the documentary. In reality, I went back inside. My friends and I didn't want that day to end, so we decided to stay on for a while longer. We went to the primary school, where there was more space to run around and play cops and robbers. Then we played Mango Mango, where you make a circle and sing. Then when the song stops, everyone has to freeze. Anyone who moves or laughs is out. We came home from school late that day. Usually we leave at 1 p.m., but that day we stayed till 3 p.m. Before we left, Muniba and I had an argument over something so silly I can't remember what it was. Our friends couldn't believe it. "You two always argue when there's an important occasion," they said. It wasn't a good way to leave things. I told the documentary makers, "They cannot stop me. I will get my education if it's at home, school, or somewhere else. This is our request to the world, to save our schools, save our Pakistan, save our Swat." When I got home, I cried and cried. I didn't want to stop learning. I was only 11 years old. I felt as though I had lost everything. I had told everyone in my class that the Taliban wouldn't go through with this. "They're just like our politicians. They talk the talk, but they won't do anything," I'd said. But then they went ahead. They closed our school, and I felt embarrassed. I couldn't control myself. I was crying. My mother was crying. But my father insisted, "You will go to school." For him, the closing of the schools also meant the loss of business. The boys' school would reopen after the winter holidays, but the loss of the girls' school represented a big cut in our income. More than half the school fees were overdue, and my father spent the last day chasing money to pay the rent, the utility bills, and the teachers' salaries. That night, the air was full of artillery fire, and I woke up 3 times. The next morning, everything had changed. I began to think that maybe I should go to Peshawar or abroad, or maybe I could ask our teachers to form a secret school in our home, as some Afghans had done. Afterward, I went on as many radio and TV channels as possible. "They can stop us going to school, but they can't stop us learning," I said. I sounded hopeful, but in my heart, I was worried. My father and I went to Peshawar and visited lots of places to tell people what was happening. I spoke of the irony of the Taliban wanting female teachers and doctors for women, yet not letting girls go to school to qualify for these jobs. Once, Muslim Khan had said girls should not go to school and learn Western ways. This from a man who had lived so long in America. He insisted he would have his own educational system. "What would Muslim Khan use instead of the stethoscope and the thermometer?" my father asked. "Are there any Eastern instruments which will treat the sick?" "The Taliban is against education because they think that when a child reads a book or learns English or studies science, he or she will become westernized. But," I said, "education is education. We should learn everything and then choose which path to follow. Education is neither Eastern nor Western. It is human." My mother used to tell me to hide my face when I spoke to the media because at my age, I should be in Purda, and she was afraid for my safety. But she never banned me from doing anything. It was a time of horror and fear. People often said the Taliban might kill my father, but not me. "Malala is a child," they would say, "and even the Taliban don't kill children." But my grandmother wasn't so sure. Whenever my grandmother saw me speaking on television or leaving the house, she would pray, "Please God, make Malala like Benazir Bhutto, but do not give her Benazir's short life." After my school closed down, I continued to write the blog. 4 days after the ban on girls' schools, 5 more were destroyed. "I am quite surprised," I wrote, "because these schools had closed, so why did they also need to be destroyed? No one has gone to school following the Taliban's deadline. The army is doing nothing about it. They are sitting in their bunkers on top of the hills. They slaughter goats and eat with pleasure." I also wrote about people going to watch the floggings announced on Mullah FM radio and the fact that the police were nowhere to be seen. One day, we got a call from America, from a student at Stanford University. Her name was Shiza Shaheed, and she came from Islamabad. She had seen the New York Times documentary, "Class Dismissed," and tracked us down. We saw then the power of the media, and she became a great support to us. My father was almost bursting with pride at how I came across on the documentary. "Look at her," he told Adam Ehrlich. "Don't you think she is meant for the skies?" Fathers can be very embarrassing. Adam took us to Islamabad. It was the first time I had ever visited. Islamabad was a beautiful place with nice white bungalows and broad roads, though it has none of the natural beauty of Swat. We saw the Red Mosque where the siege had taken place, the wide, wide Constitution Avenue leading to the white colonnaded buildings of the Parliament and Presidency where Zardari now lived. General Musharraf was in exile in London. We went to shops where I bought school books, and Adam bought me DVDs of American TV programs like Ugly Betty, which was about a girl with big tooth braces and a big heart. I loved it and dreamed of one day going to New York and working on a magazine like her. We visited the Lok Virsa Museum, and it was a joy to celebrate our national heritage once again. Our own museum in Swat had closed. On the steps outside, an old man was selling popcorn. he was a Pashtun like us. And when my father asked if he was from Islamabad, he replied, "Do you think Islamabad can ever belong to us Pashtuns?" He said he came from Momand, one of the tribal areas, but had to flee because of a military operation. I saw tears in my parents' eyes. Lots of buildings were surrounded by concrete blocks, and there were checkpoints for incoming vehicles to guard against suicide bombs. When our bus hit a pothole on the way back, my brother Khushal, who had been asleep, jerked awake. "Was that a bomb blast?" he asked. This was the fear that filled our daily lives. Any small disturbance or noise could be a bomb or gunfire. On our short trips, we forgot our troubles back home in Swat. But we returned to the threats and danger as we entered our valley once again. Even so, Swat was our home, and we were not ready to leave it. Back in Mingora, the first thing I saw when I opened my wardrobe was my uniform school bag and geometry set. I felt so sad. The visit to Islamabad had been a lovely break, but this was my reality now. 14. A funny kind of peace. When my brother's schools reopened after the winter break, Khushal said he would rather stay at home like me. I was cross. "You don't realize how lucky you are," I told him. It felt strange to have no school. We didn't even have a television set, as someone had stolen ours while we were in Islamabad, using my father's getaway ladder to get inside. Someone gave me a copy of The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho, a fable about a shepherd boy who travels to the pyramids in search of treasure, when all the time, it's at home. I loved that book and read it over and over again. "When you want something, all the universe conspires in helping you achieve it," it says. I don't think the person who wrote that had come across the Taliban or our useless politicians. What I didn't know was that Haikakar was holding secret talks with Fazlullah and his commanders. He had got to know them in interviews and was urging them to rethink their ban on girls' education. "Listen, Molana," he told Fazlullah. "You killed people, you slaughtered people, you beheaded people, you destroyed schools, and still there was no protest in Pakistan. But when you banned girls' education, people spoke out. Even the Pakistan media, which has been so soft on you till now, is outraged." The pressure from the whole country worked on Fazlullah, and he agreed to lift the ban for girls up to 10 years old, so year 4. I was in year 5, and some of us pretended we were younger than we were. We started going to school again, dressed in ordinary clothes and hiding our books under our shawls. It was risky, but it was the only ambition I had back then. We were lucky, too, that Madam Maryam was brave and resisted pressure to stop working. She had known my father since she was 10, and they trusted each other completely. She used to signal to him to wind up when he spoke for too long, which was often. "The secret school is our silent protest," she told us. I didn't write anything about it in my diary. If they had caught us, they would have flogged or even slaughtered us as they had Shabana. Some people are afraid of ghosts, some of spiders or snakes. In those days, we were afraid of our fellow human beings. On the way to school, I sometimes saw the Taliban with their caps and long dirty hair. Most of the time, they hid their faces. They were awkward looking, horrible looking. The streets of Mingora were empty now, as a third of the inhabitants had left the valley. My father said you couldn't really blame people for leaving, as the government had no power. There were now 12,000 army troops in the region, 4 times as many as their estimates of the Taliban, along with tanks, helicopters, and sophisticated weapons. Yet 70% of Swat was under Taliban control. About a week after we had returned to school on 16th February 2009, we were woken one night by the sound of gunfire. Our people traditionally fire rifles in celebration of births and weddings, but even that had stopped during the conflict. So at first we thought we were in danger. Then we heard the news. The gunfire was in celebration. A peace deal had been struck between the Taliban and the provincial government, which was now under the control of the ANP, not the mullahs. The government agreed to impose Shariat law throughout Swat, and in return, the militants would stop fighting. The Taliban agreed a 10-day truce, and as a peace gesture, released a Chinese telephone engineer who they had kidnapped 6 months before. We were happy too. My father and I had often spoken in favor of a peace deal, but we questioned how it would work. People hoped that the Taliban would settle down, go back to their homes, and live as peaceful citizens. People convinced themselves that the Shariat they were introducing would be different from the Afghan version. We would still have our girls' schools, and there would be no morality police. Swat would be Swat, just with a different justice system. I wanted to believe this, but I was worried. I thought surely how the system works depends on the people overseeing it, the Taliban. And it was hard to believe it was all over. More than 1,000 ordinary people and police had been killed. Women had been kept in Purda. Schools and bridges had been blown up. Businesses had closed. We had suffered barbaric public courts and violent justice and had lived in a constant state of fear. And now it was all to stop. At breakfast, I suggested to my brothers that we should talk of peace now and not of war. As ever, they ignored me and carried on with their war games. Khushal had a toy helicopter and Atal a pistol made of paper, and one would shout fire and the other take position. I didn't care. I went and looked at my uniform, happy that I would soon be able to wear it openly. A message came from our headmistress that exams would take place the first week of March. It was time to get back to my books. Our excitement did not last long. Just 2 days later, I was on the roof of the Taj Mahal Hotel giving an interview about the peace deal to a well-known reporter called Hamid Mir, when we got the news that another TV reporter we knew had been killed. His name was Musa Khan Khail, and he had often interviewed my father. That day, he had been covering a peace march led by Sufi Muhammad. It wasn't really a march, but a cavalcade of cars. Afterwards, Musa Khan's body was found nearby. He had been shot several times, and his throat partly slit. He was 28 years old. My mother was so upset when we told her that she went to bed in tears. She was worried that violence had returned to the valley so soon after the peace deal. Was the deal merely an illusion, she wondered. A few days later, on 22nd February, a permanent ceasefire was announced by Deputy Commissioner Saeed Javed at the Swat Press Club in Mingora. He appealed to all the Swatis to return. The Taliban spokesman Muslim Khan then confirmed they had agreed an indefinite ceasefire. President Zardari would sign the peace deal into law. The government also agreed to pay compensation to the families of victims. Everyone was jubilant, but I felt the happiest because it meant school would reopen properly. The Taliban said girls could go to school after the peace agreement, but they should be veiled and covered. We said, okay, if that's what you want, as long as we can live our lives. Not everyone was happy about the deal. Our American allies were furious. I think the Pakistan government is basically abdicating to the Taliban and the extremists, said Hillary Clinton, the US Secretary of State. The Americans were worried the deal meant surrender. The Pakistani newspaper Dawn wrote in an editorial that the deal sent a disastrous signal. Fight the state militarily and it'll give you what you want and get nothing in return. But none of those people had to live here. We needed peace, whoever brought it. In our case, it happened to be a 78-year-old white-bearded militant called Sufi Muhammad. He made a peace camp in Deir and sat there in our famous mosque, Tabligh Markaz, like the master of our land. He was the guarantor that the Taliban would lay down their arms and there would be peace in the valley. People visited him to pay homage and kiss his hand, because they were tired of war and suicide bombings. In early March, I stopped writing my blog, as Haikakar and I thought there would not be much more to say. But to our horror, things didn't change much. If anything, the Taliban had become even more barbaric. They were now state-sanctioned terrorists. We were disillusioned and disappointed. The peace deal was merely a mirage. One night, the Taliban held a flag march near our street and patrolled the roads with guns and sticks as if they were the army. They were still patrolling the China Bazaar. One day, my mother went shopping with my cousin as she was getting married and wanted to shop for her wedding. A Taliban accosted them and blocked their way. "If I see you again wearing a scarf but no burqa, I will beat you," he said. My mother is not easily scared and remained composed. "Yes, okay. We will wear burqas in future," she told him. My mother always covers her head, but the burqa is not part of our Pashtun tradition. We also heard that Taliban had attacked a shopkeeper because an unaccompanied woman was looking at the lipsticks in his beauty shop. "There is a banner in the market saying women are not allowed to be in your shop unaccompanied by a male relative, and you have defied us," they said. He was badly beaten, and nobody helped him. One day, I saw my father and his friends watching a video on his phone. It was a shocking scene. A teenage girl wearing a black burqa and red trousers was lying face down on the ground, being flogged in broad daylight by a bearded man in a black turban. "Please stop it," she begged in Pashto, in between screams and whimpers as each blow was delivered. "In the name of Allah, I am dying." You could hear the Taliban shouting, "Hold her down! Hold her hands down!" At one point during the flogging, her burqa slips, and they stop for a moment to adjust it, then carry on beating her. They hit her 34 times. A crowd had gathered, but did nothing. One of the woman's relatives even volunteered to help hold her down. A few days later, the video was everywhere. A woman filmmaker in Islamabad got hold of it, and it was shown on Pakistan TV over and over, and then round the world. People were rightly outraged, but this reaction seemed odd to us, as it showed they had no idea of the awful things going on in our valley. I wished their outrage extended to the Taliban's banning of girls' education. Our Prime Minister, Yusuf Raza Gilani, called for an inquiry and made a statement saying the flogging of the girl was against the teachings of Islam. "Islam teaches us to treat women politely," he said. Some people even claimed the video was fake. Others said that the flogging had taken place in January before the peace deal and had been released now to sabotage it. But Muslim Khan confirmed it was genuine. "She came out of her house with a man who was not her husband, so we had to punish her," he said. "Some boundaries cannot be crossed." Around the same time in early April, another well-known journalist called Zahid Hussain came to Swat. He went to visit the DC at his official residence and found him hosting what appeared to be a celebration of the Taliban takeover. There were several senior Taliban commanders with armed escorts, including Muslim Khan and even Fakir Mohammed, the leader of militants in Bajor, who were in the middle of a bloody fight with the army. Fakir was supposed to have a $200,000 bounty on his head. Yet there he was, sitting in a government official's house, having dinner. We also heard that an army brigadier went to prayers led by Fazlullah. "There cannot be two swords in one sheath," said one of my father's friends. "There cannot be two kings in one land. Who is in charge here, the government or Fazlullah?" But we still believed in peace. Everyone was looking forward to a big public meeting at Grassy Ground on 20th April, where Sufi Muhammad would address the people of Swat. We were all at home that morning. My father and brothers were standing outside when a group of teenage Taliban went past playing victory songs on their mobiles. "Oh, look at them, Abba," said Hushal. "If I had a Kalashnikov, I would kill them." It was a perfect spring day. Everyone was excited because they hoped Sufi Muhammad would proclaim peace and victory and ask the Taliban to lay down their arms. My father didn't attend the gathering. He watched it from the roof of Sarosh Academy, the school run by his friend Ahmed Shah, where he and other activists often gathered in the evenings. The roof overlooked the stage, so some media had set up their cameras there. There was a huge crowd, between 30,000 and 40,000 people, wearing turbans and singing Taliban and jihadi songs. "It was complete Talibanization humming," said my father. Liberal progressives like him did not enjoy the singing and chanting. They thought it was toxic, especially at times like this. Sufi Muhammad was sitting on the stage with a long queue of people waiting to pay homage. The meeting started with recitations from the chapter of victory, a surah from the Quran, followed by speeches from different leaders of the five districts of our valley, Kohistan, Malakand, Shangla, Upper Dir and Lower Dir. They were all very enthusiastic, as each one was hoping to be made the Amir of their district so they could be in charge of imposing Shariat.